Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal health and well-being and what's going on in our total health environment. And what is our health environment? Our health environment is the larger context of resources and harms that we are intimately connected to and which impact our health. So on this program every week, we talk about the health of our food, water, air, earth, healthcare system. We talk about the health of our communities, about the health of our society, about the ecological balance of our habitat, planet Earth. Each week on the show, we welcome different scientists, experts, thought leaders, authors, doctors, filmmakers, journalists, and a whole host of people, each of whom focuses on and reveals in depth a specific aspect of our interconnected world that deeply affects our health. On the program this week, I am delighted to welcome back a guest who's been on the program before, and it's been, gosh, I think it's been about 5 years ago now at least, since we welcomed on the show Dr. Ted Shettler. Dr. Shettler is a really, really interesting, has a very interesting, broad, and deep background in what we'll be discussing today, the science, regulation, policy, and health impact of toxic chemicals. Presently, Dr. Shettler is Science Director of the Science and Environmental Health Network. He has also served as the Science Director of the Collaborative on Health and the Environment. He's a former director, member of the Steering Committee of the Physicians for Social Responsibility, and, you know, has been on their environmental committee and all of that. Dr. Shettler has a very interesting background. He's both an MD who has been in clinical frontline medical practice in, you know, emergency services and internal medicine as well, as well as holding a master's in public health. So he's one of the unique doctors who both has an in-depth knowledge of health in the human body and serving individuals in health crisis and challenge, as well as thinking in the big picture about what we need to do on a societal, systemic level to protect the health and well-being of all people and all resources that we need for health and life. So delighted to have you here today with us, Ted Shettler.
Thank you very much, Allison. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
So today we are talking because the current administration, which we know on a variety of fronts, has taken a kind of adversarial and ignorant stance, frankly, towards science on many different fronts. And, you know, we've heard about it in climate science with repealing all kinds of programs at the EPA. There are many different kinds of, you know, it's true in terms of public health and healthcare. Many kinds of supports are rolled back. We're also seeing it in the area of food and agriculture, you know, regulation of pharmaceuticals on many, many different fronts. You know, it seems almost like every day, you know, there's something new erupting where people are opposing science and trying to replace it to meet other agendas without regard for the impacts on our health. And this is happening right now, and it's happened in the past week in which we are talking in the area of the science and regulation of toxic chemicals. The director, chief of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, her name is Linda Birnbaum, and she's a longtime senior governmental scientist, highly regarded in the field, wrote an editorial that has come under an attack by several members of Congress on the House of Representatives Science Committee. And these two of the representatives, Lamar Smith and Andy Biggs, have complained that in writing a scientific editorial, Linda Birnbaum was lobbying. And, you know, basically what she said is that there is a gap between what the scientific evidence shows and the policies that are in place you know, put together by citizens, by scientists and non-scientists, the health protective policies based on the best evidence, you know, are not being enacted, they're not being passed. It's basically, she's saying, we have the scientific evidence, but we're not following through on that evidence to protect public health. And it is for making that statement in her editorial, and of course that really is the mandate of her department. That's what they're supposed to do. Dr. Birnbaum has come under attack. So today we're going to be talking with Ted Shettler about the science and regulatory policy and history of the effects of toxic chemicals on humans and other life forms, to just get a handle on what the science shows, what we should be doing, and what that gap is. So let's go on from there. You know, one of the things that I have looked at and written about a great deal in the past is the fact that for, I think it's going on 40 years now, there have been repeated attempts under the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, to fully regulate more and more of the, you know, 80,000 toxic chemicals that are in wide use in consumer products and industry and a whole host of uses that you know, have not been fully studied and that we're kind of taking for granted as safe, but may in fact have health impacts that are undesirable. Can you just give our listeners a little bit of a context of where we are with regulation?
Yes, I'd be glad to do that, Allison. The law that is intended and has been intended to regulate toxic or chemicals in the environment, industrial chemicals, chemicals that are in consumer products that get released into the environment and so on, there was a law passed called the Toxic Substances Control Act, which we'll call TSCA, is the acronym, in 1976. And as you have mentioned, there really hadn't been much in any kind of updating of TSCA since 1976. It is the singular environmental law that did not undergo any updating at all to reflect what the emerging science since it was first passed in 1976, despite many efforts on the part of many people to do that, until 2016, when finally some amendments were passed that are known as the Lautenberg Chemical Safety Act for the 21st century, which did a major overhaul of TSCA. Now, TSCA had a number of deficiencies. You referred to one of the major ones when you introduced this by saying that chemicals had been presumed safe that were on the market. And when TSCA was passed in 1976, all the chemicals that were in current use were allowed to be continued in the marketplace without any real assessment of their safety. So they were grandfathered. And the new law, 2016 Lautenberg Act, took that head on and said that chemicals that are in the marketplace need to undergo an evaluation that will enable us to say whether or not they represent an unreasonable risk of harm. And in order to do that, with this huge backlog of thousands of chemicals, as you mentioned, we don't really know how many chemicals are in the inventory. That's one of the things we're going to hopefully find out. But we know that there are several thousands of chemicals that are in widespread use that are high production volume chemicals, about which we know very little. And so one of the tasks under the new Lautenberg law is to prioritize those chemicals that are in current use and then begin to name high priority chemicals that need a closer look, at the same time that it had a provision for creating a class of low priority chemicals where it was felt that they were not likely to present an unreasonable risk of harm based on what we know about them. So that has to do with the chemicals in existence. Then another entire section of the new Lautenberg Act addresses new chemicals that are being proposed for the market. And under the old TSCA, if a chemical manufacturer intended to produce and market a new chemical, that manufacturer simply needed to give notice to the EPA that that was their intent. If the EPA did not respond within 90 days, the chemical was free to go onto the marketplace. There was no minimum requirement for any safety assessment. It was just simply a matter of saying, this is the chemical we intend to market, this is the number that's assigned to it, and this is what we intend to do with it, and that was about it. So the Lautenberg bill that was passed in 2016 said, we really need to take a look at these new chemicals before they go onto the market and decide whether they are likely to present an unreasonable risk of harm. So those two categories, looking at the old existing chemicals and new provisions for looking at new chemicals, was enacted in 2016. But as you mentioned, under the new Trump administration, some of these provisions are being flat out ignored by the current U.S. EPA in ways that are really circumventing the intent of the Lautenberg Act. Now, I have no idea what Linda Birnbaum was referring to in her commentary in terms of the policies that she had in mind, but simply to say that that calling for translating science into policy is an awful lot like calling for translating science into more modern medical care. We should be taking what we're learning in the science, whether it's in a laboratory or out in the public health evaluations, and using that science to improve public health, or in the case of medicine, to improve individual health. So I don't see any problem with what she said, but the backdrop is this TSCA reform that happened in 2016 that is not being implemented as the law requires.
Yes, that makes complete sense. And when you describe the backlog, you know, it really is quite shocking. I began writing a lot about this after the President's Cancer Panel of 2010, which had originally been put into motion by President Bush. And their findings were that toxic chemicals were the major unassessed contributor to diseases like cancer. And, you know, they had a whole bunch of recommendations because, you know, we've gotten a billion or trillion-dollar industry treating cancer, but we don't ever think about, you know, what could increase its prevalence or what is increasing its prevalence. And it's just been really hard for people to get their mind around it since 2010, when a panel of medical experts and, you know, from leading hospitals like MD Anderson made these recommendations. You know, very little has moved forward. You know, one of the things I think is, you know, people get sick one by one by one, one at a time. And it's really hard to know of all the myriad things, you know, with which each one of us comes into contact, you know, like we're kind of freed from thinking about it. If the government had been, you know, all these years doing their job and everything, you know, had been tested and was okay and proven as safe, we're acting as if that assumption were true, when, as you state so clearly, it's really not what's happened at all. And then it kind of leaves it to people to be kind of in a state of mystery, and, you know, maybe not even wanting to know how all of the different things we've let into our world could possibly be contributing to health issues or health symptoms. So what is the science actually telling us in this regard?
Well, the science has addressed a number of health endpoints in addition to cancer in the last 20, 30 years that has looked at impacts on the developing fetus in great detail now, recognizing, I think, more clearly than ever that the developing organism, the developing child, beginning in utero, is exquisitely sensitive to exposure to to some industrial chemicals and chemicals and consumer products, environmental pollutants, and so on, at levels that have virtually no impact on an adult. So it's an issue of particular vulnerability of the developing fetus and the child. We've also learned that there are particular windows of vulnerability. So if an exposure happens at a particular time during pregnancy or childhood, it could have an impact that wouldn't occur if the exposure happened at another time. We've also learned that, and one of the major findings that's been confirmed time and time again now, is whereas we used to think that the dose made the poison, that is, if a chemical is hazardous, there's a threshold below which we need not worry. And then as the dose or the exposure increases, the risk of an adverse health effect steadily increases as well. That's certainly true for many chemicals, but we've now learned that some chemicals don't have that kind of a dose response curve. That is, we've learned, particularly in the whole area of so-called endocrine disruptors, that very low levels of exposure can have impacts that disappear at even higher levels of exposure. So we need to begin to think about the impacts of the low-level exposures that are happening in the general population to chemicals that we wouldn't have previously worried so much about. And finally, we've learned that these impacts of early life exposure can actually reveal themselves decades later. Just to give you an example, we've learned in the last few years that lifetime lead exposure, as an example, is associated with an increased risk of cognitive decline and dementia in the elderly. So what happens in your early life, beginning in utero and continuing through childhood, can have impacts on disease risk much later in life. And this would be true, for example, with various kinds of cancer, as well as neurodegenerative diseases and other disorders. So I think that a summary comment would be that the science of the last 20, 25 years is telling us that we should be really looking very carefully at the biologic effects of these thousands of chemicals that we have introduced into the environment, that work their way into people, that affect many aspects of their development, and begin to figure out how to evaluate that, which, of course, the Lautenberg bill was intended to do, to require more data to be gathered on these chemicals before they're put into the marketplace, and to get on with the task of evaluating those that are already in the marketplace with this new science in mind.
Mm-hmm. That goes right to what is the precautionary principle, which is basically encapsulates a kind of nugget of wisdom about, you know, what would be the best way to approach this, which hasn't happened. And you were, and your organization were instrumental in articulating the precautionary principle. Can you give our listeners, you know, a kind of, you know, just a basic overview of that?
Yes, I'd be glad to. It's interesting because this happens to be the 20th anniversary of the Wingspread Conference that was convened by the Science and Environmental Health Network, in which we gathered together at the Wingspread Conference Center a wide variety of expertise, scientists, physicians, economists, philosophers, public health folks, public interest groups. It was really quite a mix of participants to think about, talk about, and articulate the precautionary principle. And the Wingspread version of the precautionary principle basically says that when an activity poses threats of harm to the health, to human health or the environment, precautionary action should be taken, even if some cause and effect relationships are not fully understood scientifically. Now, if we unpack that a little bit, there are basically three parts to that. there's the plausibility of harm. So, in other words, an activity is plausibly related to an adverse outcome based on what we know about it, not just sort of having an idea that maybe something was going on, but there's a plausible possibility that the activity would be harmful. The second part says that you should take action. It's actually a directive to take action to protect human health and the environment. And the third part says you should do that even in the face of certain amounts of uncertainty, even if you don't fully understand all the cause and effect relationships. So it's interesting. It's an interesting principle in that it combines the ideas of the sort of the science of epistemology, what do we know and how do we know it, with the field of ethics that says what should we do, and it's that combination that I think makes the precautionary principle quite unique. Now, as you can imagine, this idea was not well received by many people, some of whom were extremely vocal about it, who said that it's nonsense, that what it will do is impede all progress because it will immediately require regulation, shutting down all kinds of new activities and so on. The economic impacts would be extraordinary and on. But I think that what we went on to do then was to talk about how do we implement this, because after all, it's not prescriptive. It doesn't say, okay, if there's a threat of harm, just don't do it. It doesn't say that. It says precautionary action should be taken. But then, depending on the context and the specifics, one would have to figure out what is the right thing to do. And when you begin to think about it, it makes a whole lot of common sense that you can imagine how you would implement this activity in a more constrained way until you learn more about it. You can imagine asking yourself, do we really need to do that? Are there alternative ways of accomplishing the same thing? Who should decide? So is there a democratization piece of this that we ought to consider? There are a number of steps that could be taken depending on the particular context, the particular issue. But yes, this is the 20th anniversary of that Wingspread conference.
You know, what impact has that had? Do you feel that it has, I mean, it's provided a framework for asking these very questions. It provides a framework for science. Do you think that we have advanced, on those forefronts as we should? Or, you know, is the pushback, against doing that kind of precaution, such that it makes it really difficult to, slow the dissemination of things that, you know, show a likelihood of being dangerous to health?
Well, the precautionary principle has actually been implemented in various places, and it's very place-specific. So it wasn't long after the Wingspread conference that the Unified School District of Los Angeles adopted the precautionary principle as their guide to getting the use of pesticides, the routine use of pesticides, out of their school system. They didn't say that they're never going to use them, but they went to an integrated pest management program where they would begin to look upstream for ways to prevent the pest from getting into the school buildings to begin with. And then once pesticides needed to be used, if they felt they needed to be used, they would go through an assessment of the least toxic alternatives. And they used the precautionary principle very very explicitly as the guide for doing that. A number of years later, a group got together in the Bay Area of California, the Bay Area Working Group on the Precautionary Principle, and gave some thought to how it could be implemented in this part of California. And ultimately, the city and county of San Francisco adopted the precautionary principle as a guide to all their purchasing by the government. so that now when vendors want to sell products to the city and county of San Francisco, the product undergoes a screening to see whether or not it has hazardous or toxic properties, and whether there are safer alternatives. So it's been implemented in a very real way in a purchasing policies for San Francisco. There are other examples, usually at local or regional levels, where various projects or programs have been put into place based on the precautionary principle. I think, in general, it's helped people articulate concerns that they've had that they weren't able to say quite as clearly in the past. You know, we can say things like better safe than sorry, or how do we know it's safe, and so on. But this is a way of more systematically going through an assessment of a proposed product or project to see whether or not it poses harm, to whom, to what, what's the extent, what do we know, what don't we know, and what are the alternatives. So it's quite a logical way of thinking about decisions.
That makes a lot of sense. That you know, so it actually is a set of principles that can be implemented, you know, by government organizations or other kinds of companies, nonprofits, you know, that actually provide guidelines for how to make an assessment. In terms of, you know, the you know, how we're doing on a national level, on an EPA level, you know, on the NIEHS level that Linda Birnbaum, you know, is the chief of, how are we doing on that level in terms of uncovering new science and putting in new regulations? Well, is the Lautenberg Law sufficient, or, you know, where are we with that?
Well, the Lautenberg Law was a compromise, without question. It passed in the Obama administration, and it had support from both parties. It was clearly a compromise. It addressed some of the major deficiencies of the TSCA, the 1976 bill, but the Lautenberg bill didn't do a number of things that many of us would have wanted. On the other hand, federal regulation of anything is always a compromise, and it would be obviously preferable if the Lautenberg bill were actually being implemented according to the letter of the law, which it's not. But I'd point out that the NIEHS, Linda Birnbaum's organization, is not a regulatory agency. They are strictly a science agency. Their findings that from their scientific studies, they have a large intramural program where they do scientific studies themselves, and then they have extramural program in which they fund studies that are done in universities and elsewhere around the country. They are the science arm. Their findings get reported, of course, in scientific journals, and they run the National Toxicology Program as well, where they evaluate chemicals for their cancer risks and so on. But they don't regulate any of these products or chemicals. The regulatory agencies are the EPA for industrial chemicals, and of course the FDA for pharmaceuticals and for many kinds of consumer products as well.
And so, in fact, it's the scientist talking across the, you know, Linda Birnbaum's statement is the scientist talking across the aisle to the regulators and the legislators, and then in this case, you know, which is in fact like what her science is being done for, and that's kind of a, you know, sort of legitimate use by government agencies of government science, and yet in this particular instance, this recent incident, you know, the legislators are kind of saying, you know, put a cork in it. you know, we don't want to hear from you. And of course, that's inconsistent with the, you know, with the other, you know, the rest of the administration's approach to any form of environmental or health policy. This is more of the same. But if there were a stall, or, you know, we hope it won't happen, certainly, and there's no current indication that it will, although it has happened in other agencies, that there is a strip down and a takedown of laws that were formerly on the books. So, you know, here we have a situation where, you know, the scientist is saying more regulation, more policy is needed, you know, but we also have an administration that's been stripping down existing protections and policies. You know, what I think when that happens, you know, there's kind of like people who understand, you know, this area are kind of like shocked and concerned. The general public may just be sort of puzzled and not really understand what kind of impacts potentially we could be seeing if there's a, you know, any kind of rollback or even stalling of existing regulations in this area.
That's right. I think it's important to remember that the regulations that are on the books were put there for very good reasons. Just to use an example, I mean, the Clean Air Act and the amendments that have happened over the years and the ratcheting down of the permissible levels of air pollutants has been based on extraordinary scientific work that's been going on for decades, literally, where epidemiologists as well as laboratory scientists have carefully studied the health impacts of exposure to various kinds of air pollutants. Particulate air pollutants are among them, and of course then there's ozone, and there are the sulfur oxides and nitrogen oxides and so on that are regulated by the Clean Air Act for very good reason, because the data have developed over time showing the number of premature deaths that are associated with exposure to certain levels of air pollution. And it was based on those scientific studies, which were at the time challenged often by the regulated industry and withstood that kind of scrutiny, that are now being rolled back to some extent by simply not enforcing certain emission requirements that were in place during the previous administration. I mean, that's just one of the latest things that's happened. So the end result will be that certain coal-fired power plants, as an example, will now be permitted to release more air pollutants into the air that we know are associated with an increased risk of premature death among certain people in the population. Now, if somebody... one of the problems is that, of course, a cardiovascular death is hard to attribute on an individual level to the air pollution that person might have been breathing, because, as we know, cardiovascular disease is a result of a variety of things that come together, not just air pollution, but you know, your blood pressure, your family history, your cholesterol levels, your exercise levels, your weight, and so on. All of those things combine to create cardiovascular disease, and air pollution is among them. And so it's very difficult to attribute a specific person's death to air pollution, but that's why these studies were done. And so we can say with some confidence that there will be a number of premature deaths that will result from the failure to enact the stricter regulations on air pollution. And that's just the way it is. That's what's going to happen. And Scott Pruitt's EPA will just simply have to ignore those data in order to do what they're doing, or at least to make an argument that somehow those premature deaths are acceptable for some reason.
Well, the whole problem there is that, you know, nobody knows whose premature death it is. You know,
that's precisely,
is it
right,
oneself? Is it one's relative? You know, it, and the tendency will be to think, well, it, you know, it's somebody else. It couldn't, you know, it couldn't be me. And there's no way to say, you know, like, we don't know who the people are. You know, if 5 years from now or 10 years from now people develop, you know, cancer or heart disease or any of the other diseases that we're talking about, we don't know who among them would have been living, you know, a longer life.
Precisely.
You know.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. It's a very important point that this is one of the challenges of public health, is that when you study diseases in populations, you get data that apply to the populations, but you can't extrapolate it necessarily to the individual. There are very few common diseases or even uncommon diseases that are attributable to single causes that makes it extraordinarily difficult to address as a public health matter. I mean, we know that if a person has mesothelioma, which is a particular kind of lung cancer, that the likelihood is that that person was exposed to asbestos. That mm-hmm. that link between asbestos and mesothelioma is quite clear. It's been known for a long time, and but it's the exception rather than the rule that we would know one agent and one disease. But more often, in fact, it's rather as the rule is that that there are multiple contributing factors, risk factors they're often called, that can contribute to a particular disease outcome. And therefore, as you mm-hmm. said, it's very difficult to identify the individual person who was affected by that particular environmental agent, but rather we only know that from population studies.
Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is that, you know, having basically reported in the health field, you know, for 25 years, I know, you know, in pitching stories and writing books and writing stories and articles and everything that I've done, you know, in framing the way that we educate and teach people about matters like these or about ways they can promote their own health on an individual basis, you know, it's always framed along the lines of what can someone do? And, you know, what can I, the consumer, do? It's always, you know, it's in people's minds to try to seek a personal solution as a patient, as a consumer, as an individual. And the idea that I'm increasing, you know, I can personally choose to eat organic food, let's say, as long as the organic food standards are well protected, which right now they aren't. But, you know, I could avoid pesticide exposure for you know, if I eat organic food. That's something I personally have done for decades, right? And I'm the editor of a paper in an organic food co-op. I've supported that organization, you know. So I can make that choice as an individual, and that's what we're kind of always taught to do. What choice can I make as an individual? And so we're kind of striving to reduce our risk factors as an individual without really knowing how to kind of band together as a group to address these areas of risk that are outside of individual choice because they're made on a government policy level. So if the organic standards become adulterated and more pesticides and noxious ingredients are included, you know, if I'm not paying attention or I'm not activated and I allow that, or, you know, a bad administration comes in and that happens, then, you know, something I thought I was doing or planned to do personally, eat healthy food, is no longer possible. Some, you know, if I can't avoid every product, I can't avoid every industrial exposure, you know, I could fight to prevent a pipeline from coming to my region, for example, you know. So, and people, you know, it's like almost they want to know there's something that they absolutely can do, and yet these are things that we all have to do together. I had another guest that I'd interviewed on an earlier broadcast was talking about, you know, the ingredients, the toxic ingredients, you know, that are in flame retardants and everything that are in furniture, and basically was saying, you know, our goal has been to influence the manufacturers because if they use these ingredients, people don't have that much choice about being exposed to them. And so there's a lot of things like that, but we haven't been taught so much. We have to activate and get together on this, you know, and make sure this happens. You know, we're always looking for, well, how can I make a personal consumer or health choice, you know, that will kind of protect me from this? I'd just be curious, you know, what thoughts you have about that, because this is something that if we're talking about public health in a larger sense, a more systemic view of the health of our society, which of course is what you are, you know, working on and pointing at, that's kind of, you know, it's not something the average individual identifies with, is affecting them, or feels much about.
Yeah, I think you've hit on a number of important points, Allison. The idea that that individual action can make a difference, and I'm, and the place that people often turn to first, and I certainly encourage that. People can make choices for themselves and their families, in their homes, what kinds of things they purchase, what products they bring in, and learn something about them. But you're right. There's a limit to how much that approach can help solve the problems. And clearly, things like the quality of the air that we're breathing, the chemicals that are in the furniture that you're bringing into your house, as you just mentioned, often they simply can't be addressed by individual action. You also pointed out that in addition to government regulation, there are opportunities for market-based campaigns. And I think that's one of the things that we're all seeing, is that consumers who are concerned have band together and are beginning to ask manufacturers about products in ways that they never did before. What's in this cosmetics? You know, what's in this couch? What's in this television or laptop? What's in this chair? And are there flame retardants in this foam? And if the manufacturer can't answer the question or doesn't choose to answer the question, a consumer can go elsewhere. And this kind of consumer activism is really beginning to take shape around the country in a variety of ways. It's happening with the food we eat. It's happening with our consumer products we bring into our houses. And so we now are seeing an increase in labeling laws, for example, or labeling efforts to inform consumers about what is or what's not in a product to make them feel more at ease. But that can cut both ways. Just to give you an example, many of your listeners will be aware of the controversy over bisphenol A or BPA, which is a chemical that's used to make polycarbonate plastic that has been used in food containers and baby bottles and so on for years. It's also used to coat thermal receipts. And there's a growing concern about the safety of bisphenol A because of its endocrine-disrupting properties. And so a few years ago, some companies decided that there was a marketing opportunity here, and they moved away from bisphenol A in their products to alternatives, and then they were advertising them on the package as saying this bottle, for example, is BPA-free. But what they didn't tell the consumer was what the alternative product was that they were using, and it turned out that in many cases it was an analog very similar to bisphenol A called BPS or something similar that clearly now we know has very similar toxic properties. But since it's not BPA, it was being used as a marketing ploy. So we always have to be a little circumspect about labeling and the honesty in labeling. But I guess my larger point is that consumer demand and consumer questions can begin to drive the markets in ways that actually work ahead of regulatory efforts.
Because I'm a kind of, in addition to being a reporter, I'm kind of a media analyst, right? So I'm looking at, you know, what stories are coming up in the media and what people are, you know, what the public is being told and what different, individuals or companies are sort of putting out there in a manner of educating, just as we're doing, but influencing people. You know, this happens all the time. And so, for example, when you talk about labeling, I'm aware that 3 days ago, Tom Vilsack, who is the former head of the USDA under the Obama administration, has published an article in U.S. News and World Report and it's called Stop the Food Label Fearmongering. It appears that Tom Vilsack, who for many years worked for the dairy industry and the food industry, maybe has returned to a role as a spokesperson or, consultant of some kind, and he's now arguing against labeling, as something that is going to make people worried, raise useless questions, erode consumer trust. And, he actually has an op-ed published about that. So, it's kind of sometimes feels that, we advance an initiative such as labeling on one side, and then, that very kind of initiative is, sort of knocked down or, a bad jacket is hung on that thing on another side. So it's really interesting what you say. I mean, labels are really the crux of our ability to decide. We can trust, but in the context that you're talking about for science and regulation, we don't have a reason to. We have less of a reason to. I mean, 40 years of not really being able to get a handle on the regulations all that well is not a reason to trust. And the current actions of this administration is not a reason to trust. And having a former top regulator, leaving the government and speaking against labels as, the former head of the USDA, even under, a more favorable administration, that also doesn't guarantee trust. So, how do people who want to have impact, on a systemic level, what can they do? Can they support your organization? What do you, are there advocacy groups you like? What do you recommend they do?
Well, I don't want to begin naming names of advocacy groups because I'd be certain to leave some out. But yes, there are a number of advocacy groups, nonprofits, that are working on various aspects of this set of problems. Just to give you an example, when the Lautenberg bill was being debated in Congress, I mean, there were a number of advocacy groups, some working alone and some working together, that weighed in heavily and regularly on this to try to influence, with some success, to influence the final shape of that bill. So it was really a concerted effort that went on for several years that your listeners should be aware of, that was going on the part of nonprofits. There are efforts to pass certain kinds of legislation at the state level as well as in the federal level that people should perhaps take a look at. Some states have much more progressive opportunities than others, whether it's around labeling laws, disclosure laws, and so on. But those are the areas, and I also think that using your purchasing power, asking questions about what's in products, and insisting on getting an answer before you'll buy something. I mean, manufacturers and the retail outlets need to understand that customers care about these things. I mean, you're seeing, for example, some real movement now in Walmart and Target and other large chains that have made commitments to, over a period of time, to move certain chemicals of concern out of their merchandise because of consumer efforts and consumer concerns and market-based campaigns that have been leaning on them to do this. So there are plenty of efforts for individuals to join in trying to promote these changes at local, state, regional, market, and federal levels.
That's great. Well, that's good to know. And I just want to give a shout-out as well to your organization. It's online at sehn.org, C-E-H-N, .org. S-E-H-N, that's right.
S-E-H-N,
yes, that's right. I'm looking at the S, and I'm saying C for some unknown reason. Go to the website. You'll find a way to donate. There's a tab for that. There's also blogs, updates, information about the precautionary principle, which we've discussed on this program, about ecological medicine, which is the connection between health and our environment. We have about one more minute or so, 2 minutes. Could you say quick something about that? I think that's an interesting area.
Well, ecological medicine is an effort to reconnect medicine with public and environmental health. You know, they've been separated for so long, but we, as you've mentioned, understand how deeply integrated we are as individuals and families and communities into the ecological systems that support us. We'll begin to think about both those relationships and how to influence them in healthy ways. That's ecological medicine. That's, instead of thinking about medicine as applies only to an individual or a family, we think about medicine as applies to the complex nested set of relationships that I've mentioned. It opens up a whole new way of thinking about our relationship with the world we live in and how we can act in ways that are beneficial across that spectrum of organizations, from the individual to the planetary level, really.
Thank you. That's really beautifully said. That's the kind of expansion of our view of health that's really needed to carry us through and guide our most high priority engagements and interventions in this time. Thank you so much for being with me today on Connect the Dots. Ted Shetler, Medical Science Director of SEHN, S-E-H-N, the Science and Environmental Health Network. Thank you for the years of work you put into all of this and for appearing and commenting and updating our listeners today on Connect the Dots.
Thank you very much, Allison. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you, listeners, for being with us. We'll be back again next week, 10 a.m. Eastern Time, Wednesdays, on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week, we do a new edition of Connect the Dots. If you've enjoyed this program, please share it on social media. If you'd like friends to listen, like us on iTunes, go to the Connect the Dots archives for this and other shows, and that can be found at connectthedots.com. Podbean, podbean.com. And as we move forward each week, keep your head tall, keep moving forward, standing tall with all our relations. See you next week.